And last up on the show, I have one more piece for you. I talked to Dr. Kara Crimmin from the University of Auckland about her book, The Future is Feminine, Capitalism and the Masculine Disorder. And in our interview, Crimmin explains why she thinks that masculinity has origins in a psychological disorder. I started off our interview discussing how we define femininity and masculinity and when this can become problematic.
Can certainly expand it in one respect in terms of what femininity is often associated with. But if I can flip it around, first of all, and just talk about masculinity, because I'm not suggesting, because my subtitle of the book is Capitalism and the Masculine Disorder, where I kind of suggest that masculinity is all the hallmarks of a psychological disorder. But what I'm proposing here is that there's nothing inherently wrong with many of the traits we associate with masculinity, such as strength, assertiveness, competition, being competitive. I've just watched the Euro final, very disappointed with the outcome. And, you know, competition in sports isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's when everything, your ego is so staked in winning and you lack the emotional maturity to deal with losing, where many of the crimes are often committed. I expect there are many housewives in England right now fearing for their physical health. But it also recalls something that the black American philosopher Bell Hooks said. She said that patriarchy demands of boys and men that they commit acts of psychic self-mutilation. And we often think about patriarchy as being disadvantageous to women and advantageous to men, but this kind of puts a different gloss on it, because what she's describing here is what is being mutilated are qualities that I often associate with femininity: caring for others, sensuality, tenderness, not afraid to revealing one's frailties, being able to pull from a range of sort of emotions, and not being so invested in winning that losing for you is unbearable and often leads to violence. Well, if you think about the obvious things, such as the statistics on violence in the United States, massacres and so forth, is in nearly every instance a cisgendered male that has committed those acts. So femininity is kind of like, I think you can define it in opposition to masculinity. Masculinity is basic. Femininity is what masculinity is not. And to be a man means to repudiate those very qualities, which I think are essential to mental health and well-being.
What then characterizes a psychological disorder, and why do you believe that what is often referred to as toxic masculinity fits this label?
I oppose the kind of these medicalizing discourses that invent psychological disorders. There's a certain play on this term, but one of the things that I find a problem is the way that the media tends to focus on what is often called toxic masculinity, or the kind of worst of men, like those who commit massacres, the Donald Trump types. And it kind of reminds me of something that Primo Levi once said, and I don't attend the equivocation here with the Holocaust, but he said the monsters are far too few to worry about. It's ordinary men who are far more dangerous. And so I want to sort of shift the focus a bit away from the usual suspects and just look at how, and I bring myself into this because I was socialized to be a man, just how in an ordinary everyday level, males are typically sort of have undergone this kind of process of what Hooks calls psychic self-mutilation, or being mutilated by others, whether it's the school, media industries, peers, whatever. And so, I mean, to give you an example of how we might sort of visualize this, you know, I'm a trans woman. I present in quite overt feminine clothing, but in this kind of vernacular, I don't pass as a cis woman. So wherever I go, people look concerned. You kind of think, why? And it's like, well, even when I've gone out, for instance, dressed in men's clothes and just had long fingernails, with, you know, painted, the reactions of people are quite pronounced. And I think that what this is kind of telling of is just how unusual it is for what we think of as a male to deviate in any meaningful way in their style, perhaps even effect, from these kind of masculine norms. So anybody who does stands out from the crowd. It's like the exception that proves the rule, that the vast majority of men don't, you know, they repudiate anything associated with femininity. But I think that I think that obviously style doesn't really tell us much about an individual, but when we can say to such a large degree males don't sort of cross over into that kind of terrain, then these visual manifestations are of deeper health problems in the way that males tend to be socialized.
Are you able to provide some examples of what continues to reinforce these hegemonic gender divisions and the dominance of masculinity?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can describe this as an androcentric order. It's a masculine-centric order. And begin to think about what are the precise qualities that are being encouraged here. You know, when we also think about strong women in these superhero sort of roles, strong women are essentially good at being men. They're good at being competitive, aggressive, you know, really invested in winning and so forth. And some of the worst men are, in fact, women. And we, you know, leaders, VCs, and so forth. But what I'm kind of proposing in this respect is that the masculine ego formation is a specific kind of formation that you can even sort of situate historically within capitalism. And it's essential for capitalist reproduction and expansion. So, to give an example, you know, the capitalist class require, you know, they require the military, they require the police, they require people working in prisons, they require people rising up to the corporate ladder and prepared to act ruthlessly to smash trade unions and make people redundant. You know, these are the kind of most sort of aggressive, often dehumanized, maybe even psychopathic individuals that the capitalist class rely on. But it's not just that. Also in terms of work, being competitive, being invested in getting ahead, consumption with emphasis on status and so forth, you know, in psychoanalytic terms, you could say that there's an investment in these kind of phallic ideas, and phallic in that sense can be linked from brands or anything that represents power, authority, domination. And in psychoanalytic theory, the masculine and femininity refer to two ways in this particular canon that we relate to this kind of symbol of power, the masculine and the feminine. The masculine is invested in acquiring the subject that will prove them to, like, the real man, and the feminine is not invested in this because there's no kind of impossible ideal for the feminine subject to live up to. It doesn't have to be necessarily a male that's masculine or a female that's feminine, but how we're socialized is to be invested in this impossible thing of being the real man, of being the top dog, as it were. And I think this is, you know, at the kind of psychological libidinal level where this kind of masculine formation also lies, not just at the symbolic level of, you know, certain traits that have come in our society to be associated with the term. So by contrast, you could say, so if the qualities that are essential in a capitalist society kind of situated within the masculine, so the feminine is a kind of, if you like, this human face of this, the veneer, then if we think again of caring for others, tenderness, compassion, empathy is typically associated with femininity, puts you at a disadvantage in many ways in a capitalist society. In a non-capitalist society, a non-class society, where we're not aggressively competing to get ahead, then these very qualities that are feminine, you could say, would be the basis of that healthy society. of a healthy society, or even, if I can be provocative, a communistic society. And in that respect, you could say that masculinity is capitalistic, femininity is communistic. But, you know, in a society where we've rid ourselves of those very tendencies, those very needs to be invested in winning and so forth, then both the masculine and feminine cease to have any material psychological meaning, any relevance.
Do you believe it's possible to move from these sort of discourses of humiliation?
Well, I think we have to obviously look very carefully about how we raise children, but, you know, any parent would know that, you know, you can raise your child in whichever way you please, but you're still going to have to deal with the school and peers and aunts and uncles and so forth, and it's very difficult to do these things in isolation. But I think we, you know, we could all have a good hard look at ourselves and how we've been raised and the sort of problems we have with expressing ourselves in certain ways, how we react to certain things, and, you know, to think of how we might want to respond differently to these things, so to try and find ways in which we can address them and find more productive ways of dealing with these frustrations often that come with, yeah, like humiliation, failure, and so forth. Not just failure in the sense of your material well-being, but just in these symbolic terms. But it's not enough simply to say that, you know, we need to work on this kind of personal level. We obviously need to radically transform the institutions and apparatus of society in which we live in. You know, school, education system, university, which, you know, as a place I work in, is really horribly toxic and masculinized. And all the kind of media establishment, we need a radical transformation of these things. We need to have a different economic model. But this is one of the things that I kind of flag in the book, that actually some of the worst traits are actually found on the left as well as the right. You know, certain individuals who you know, maybe even bordering on sociopathic, narcissistic, who rise up in these movements. They have the voice, they have the power, they're prepared to act ruthlessly, and they cast the movements in their own image. They isolate and marginalize those who are perhaps sort of, you know, more tender, who are of different class, racial, gender sort of composition, whatever. And many of the movements and parties historically have been corrupted by these sort of individuals, by people who have got deep psychological problems but have a thirst not so much for justice but for power. Like, you know, you have the kind of heroic sort of man who steps forward in the march and punches the fascist in the face. What I'm saying, man is sometimes going to do the same to his wife when he gets home. He's going to muscle his way into these positions of power. And, you know, this happens not only pre-revolutionary situations, but post-revolutionary situations. You look at all of the hard men on the left that have acquired positions of power, very dangerous thing. So I think actually in terms of protests, movements, organizing against the capitalist class, we need to isolate these elements. We recognize them ourselves and actually ensure that those who do occupy leadership positions aren't these sort of people who are ruthlessly self-interested and motivated by the ego as opposed to social injustice. And often people, of course, are motivated by the ego, use social justice as a way then to gain those positions. I mean, there are ways in which we can test that and observe that and marginalize those individuals. And I think the future of society depends on it.
And that was Dr. Kara Crimmin. And for those of you wondering, her book is called The Future of Feminine Capitalism and the Masculine Disorder.